Welcome back to the Occupational Health Special Interest Group Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Studebaker. Today we welcome a very special guest, Sue Eisenhagen. She's going to discuss the physical therapist's role in the occupational health setting. Sue and her husband have been pioneers in the therapy world, developing their own system of FCEs, job analyses, work-specific testing, and return-to-work programs. She has also authored two texts on occupational medicine and rehab, Work Injury Management and Prevention, and The Comprehensive Guide to Work Injury Management. Sue has also edited and wrote for two volumes of the journal Work. She has presented occupational medicine and rehab concepts throughout the world, in Switzerland, Germany, the Netherlands, Singapore, China, Australia, Israel, England, and Canada, as well as most of the United States. In addition, Sue is also the very first president of the Occupational Health Special Interest Group. Sue, you've been an important figure in the PT world for a long time. What have been some of the main changes you've seen in regards to the physical therapist's role in the occupational health setting?
I think actually therapist roles have changed with all types of specialties over the years. And I think Occ Health is one of the issues that's developed from a change in focus within our profession. The original physical therapy and actually occupational therapy goals were to take a fairly harmed, injured person and make them functional again. And so for many years in the physical therapy profession, we dealt more with people with severe injuries such as amputations or spinal cord injury, traumatic brain injury, neurological diseases, and those were easy outcomes to make goals for because it was to be to return to function. But having been around throughout some transitions, I noticed that in the 1980s, a couple things seemed to come into play. One of the changes in our profession was the advent of computerized exercise machines. And they were real glitzy and they were great and they could do exercise and they could measure the changes in exercise. And that's all well and good. Some exist to this day. But what it did was take the focus of the therapist off the whole person and put it onto things like range of motion, of joints and strength of muscle groups, which was fine, but it almost became an end in itself. The second thing that happened during that time was the advent of mobilization and manipulation, and that was a reaction to physical therapists having excellent background to make changes in joints and be able to use their hands to decrease pain and, in some cases, increase function like range of motion. But what that did also was take the physical therapist's mind off total body function and put it into pain measurement and the continuation, of course, of range of motion. And that pain focus had really never been that big of a situation in physical therapy before. And at that point, physical therapists became known as people that could relieve your pain. The machines were people that could strengthen your muscles and joints. But those continued on even to the present day, where if you look at the curriculum of PT education, what you really see is a lot of focus on joints, muscles, and pain, and truly less focus on the whole person's function. So those are some of the changes that have happened. Along with that, if even in the DPT programs, which are supposed to be so excellent in diagnosis, treatment, making the physical therapist an entry point into the medical world, we still see a great deal of the education focused on outside diagnosis, reading x-rays, those types of things, clinical reports, and we see a great emphasis on mobilization, manipulation, We see exercise as an important factor, and we're getting very good. I wouldn't go to anybody other than a physical therapist if I had a joint or muscle problem, because they are the absolute best. And I think that's how we're trying to sell ourselves as therapists, because that's what we do so well. But what has kind of been lost through that in who we're talking about, our workers, is that the work focus has dropped and very little is taught, even in entry-level DPT programs. You'd think there would be more taught, but I think compared to the 1980s, there's less taught on the occupational specialties than there was then. Just to appreciate physical therapy, that there are other focuses where we still have sports with excellent orthopedics and excellent outcomes, but there we're talking about a sports outcome. We still have neuro, the stroke, spinal cord, and they look at, like, return to home outcomes. Children have outcomes of better engagement into the world, and geriatrics are usually a whole person function. But for the majority of who physical therapists see, who is really working age adults, I think we're educated and focused on the parts that we can help with and not necessarily the whole person. I'll just give you an example. I was at a combined section meeting probably 5 to 10 years ago and was working to tell people about programs that can educate you in ergonomics or functional testing, and talking to people that would come by, and I would say, now, are you aware when you treat a patient what their job is? And they looked, many people, students, therapists, looked at me like, what? Why would I need to know what their job is if I'm treating their shoulder or treating their back? And actually, a couple people said that out loud. Why would I need to know what they do at work? Which kind of shows to me the gap between what we're learning and what we're practicing and maybe what occupational health specialists see as important. So I think that physical therapy, except for occupational health specialists, is kind of missing a whole gamut of things where we can be extremely useful to help people return to whole body function and become very much gainfully employed and produce outcomes that help our country, their families, or whatever. In other words, we're focused on the worker being able to do a better job and stay healthy. So that's one of the changes I have really seen in background of where physical therapy is focused. In the history, as we kind of came through some awareness of occupational health, there were those of us that saw, for one reason or another, that looking at an injured person as a worker would be beneficial. Now, that happened in about the 1980s. At the same time, work comp systems were realizing, oh my goodness, these injured workers are costing us a fortune. They're bankrupting our states, our work comp funds, and the impetus for some change, unfortunately, was financial, where I think it would have been a better focus to say it's the betterment of the worker and the industries, but we'll take what we get, and financial was the reason that many of us decided to go the route of occupational health, because we thought we could make a great difference in helping injured workers get back to work. And so the original specialties in OC Health were focused at these chronically injured workers. Yes, they still got physical therapy. Yes, they still got occupational therapy, whatever they needed. But in what we were missing is a way to get people back to work, because often they were getting those therapies and still not going back to work. And the first and original program was functional capacity assessment. And the FCE was really an outcome of a format that all the state workers' comp systems adopted. And they had a list of things that the people had to do to go back to work. And so they'd give a sheet of paper to a doctor that would say, how much do you think the person can lift? And how often can they bend? How often can they sit and stand? And what can they carry? And what's their hand grip strength? And so this list of items was pre-developed for a physician to fill out. And in those days, I worked with some very sharp physicians that brought it to therapists and said, your therapist, you should be able to measure this function and identify how I can sign this release form to go back to work. And that was the beginning of functional capacity assessment as it stands today. Now, I will note that it's still a big, big referral program for physical therapists, and it still is important. The problem with it is FCAs are done at a chronic stage. They're expensive. Nobody wants to pay for them until a worker's return to work is really a problem. So it's a great beginning for us, but we have to take more out of functional testing than only an FCA. Now, the second part that dealt with those expenses was work hardening. And work hardening was, let's take people into our physical therapy areas and get them focused on returning to work. What work hardening brought to the table, and somewhat an FCA did the same thing, work hardening brought the need to know what the job required to the table. So some work hardening programs just got people stronger. Then they were handed off to a vocational specialist who would place them at work, but many work hardening programs were focused on the actual job. This person is a carpenter and these are the job requirements. Let's make sure they can lift, carry, grip, bend, climb, all of those things, and that became the goals. Well, the work hardening was the first use of goals to return someone to work, and rather than the goals being reduction in pain or increase in range of motion, the goals were return to these activities of being a carpenter or return to a work level of medium work, which is more generic but still was a goal. So, and this happened in the late 80s, early 90s. How the work hardening changed things was, first, it was multidisciplinary. CARF, the Commission on Accreditation of Rehabilitation Facilities, decided that they wanted to be the only people to accredit work hardening programs. And I was on the committee at APTA who said, no, we should have our own credentialing systems, and we're not going to let states fall victim to CARF, who's going to tell us how to do our programs. So the original work hardening committees in APTA in the early 90s was focused on bringing back the power to physical therapists and other professionals. Although with APTA, we could only write guidelines for physical therapists and include others by inference. Work hardening required physical therapy, occupational therapy, vocational rehabilitation, and psychology. So work hardening by original definition was a multidisciplinary effort. Thus, at APTA, we pulled out what we call work conditioning now. And work conditioning was the physical component, which could be done by a physical therapist. And it was to have its own codes and own billing and its own accreditation process. Today, as I look at work hardening and work conditioning and where it is in return to work, all the states have it different. Some call physical therapy only rehab work hardening. Some differentiate work hardening and work conditioning. Some states call it work conditioning. That doesn't really matter. The point is, as therapists, we realized we had a goal to use return to work goals in our treatment of patients. Again, that's a chronic stage, and work hardening clinics sprang up all over the United States because they were a way to get paid for doing good work. Clinics measured outcomes, and they could demonstrate their outcomes. We get people back to work at a 90% rate. They've been off work for a year, and our programs can get them back. I wanted to mention that outcome now because we have failed to keep up with outcome measurement. Somehow along the way, as a profession, the outcome measurements we do now are of acute care or some of it's rehab, but it tends to be how did they feel on the last visit? How much had they been improved? What do they feel functionally about themselves? And it's measured on the last visit. And then that's supposed to prove we did a good job. Interestingly enough, work hardening and work conditioning outcomes could only be measured after the person went back to work. So you had to do a follow-up with the worker to make sure they did get back to work and they did stay at work and they could work and they didn't get re-injured. So our responsibility for our patients was great because it wasn't like did we discharge them and met a goal. It was like did it hold true in the real world. And
so it's really a better outcomes measurement than is often done in the other aspects of our industry because you're really going and checking to see whether you actually succeeded or not in real life circumstances.
Yes, you're totally right, Chris. And there's two benefits of that. One benefit is you now have data to show that you are successful. And if you want other people to send you patients, whether that's employers or case managers or physicians, you can prove you actually do a good job. But the second thing is wonderful reinforcement for the therapist running the program to know that their program is making such a difference in reality, in real world outcomes. And I think I'd say there's maybe a third one. Workers, employers, and physicians and case managers all could value the physical therapist that did those kind of programs. We were seen in a high esteem by those other professionals. And we were called upon by those professionals because they valued our service. Often today, going out in the world to meet a new employer or case management group, I dared not say I'm a physical therapist because today's model of therapy is they manage costs. So they want to know how many physical therapy visits. Can you get it down to 3 from 6? You know, they see physical therapy as a consumer issue. It costs money. We need to reduce the number. But back then, we were seen as the profession to go to because we could make such a difference. And I really directly relate that to the outcomes that we were able to develop and the teamwork that was required to get a person back to work. So that is one thing that's happened, how therapy has changed and then how Occ Health got started. Then I might jump into another specialty that's happened over the years, and that's things that are done on site. And I remember my first, functional capacity assessment client that I did, you know, a good analysis of what they could do, talk to the employer. We had case conferences with the employers, with the physicians, with the workers. That FCA showed the person could go back to work, and he went back to work. But in the process, the worker said, you know, if this is the way that you showed me that I needed to lift in this eval or how I use my body, and now you've given me the information on what I can do, but I've also gone through some work conditioning with you where I'm learning to use my body better. Had I known that before I got hurt, I never would have been hurt. Well, step out the door, go to that employer and find out what's going on, at the employer site. And so I think early on-site therapy came in also in the late 80s and 90s because many people went to the work site where they knew prevention had to take place to prevent injuries, but they also knew return to work had to take place in order to get good outcomes. So in these last 25 years, on-site therapy has become a real wonderful expansion of physical therapy. Now, I have to say, occupational therapists went to the work site since, I don't know, the beginning of their profession. So they would say they were real early to the game because they always got out of the clinic and went to the work site. Physical therapists are a little newer to the game, but we can do such a good job at the work site. So if I take just the on-site part, I think the on-site development of doing job analysis and identifying what's required in a job, maybe job descriptions are the outcome, learning ergonomics so that we can modify jobs so people don't get injured, that kind of led into a type of functional testing, which then became post-offer testing, where we had to know the job before we could design tests. And post-offer testing is actually one of the prevention measures that therapists can do. That can be done on-site, and it can be done in the clinic. But all of this revolves around getting out of the clinic and going to the site in industry to see what's going on. And it also made us work with a whole team of people. Nobody that works on site doesn't know that their employer is probably the most important piece, and their work comp administrator and their safety director and their personnel or hiring director. We have to interface with all of those. We need to know the supervisors because the supervisors have to be on board with anything that goes on with the workers for prevention. And the other most important player other than the employer is really the worker. We need to not only bond with injured workers, we need to bond with all workers when we are doing prevention programs, and they need to trust us. And I'm going to just say here, the occupational health specialist is a dream in being able to manage many types of people. But if you took that physical therapist who has just been educated in parts, strength, range of motion, pain, mobilization, and put them into the employer, I've seen havoc happen, as I'm sure you have, Chris. Physical therapists without a background in what they're getting into with OC Health can make tremendous mistakes. And I can't tell you the number of therapists I brought on site because I'm actually being a consultant to their practice as they're learning how to work with employers, that the first things out of their mouth are things like, oh, my goodness, look at that harmful part of the job, right?
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. There's certainly a minimum skill set that you have to have before you can work effectively in this type of setting.
It's like, how horrible, what a terrible viewpoint to have. And you've probably seen this. They walk into the work site and see an overweight person, a very healthy, able worker. But because they're overweight, they go, oh, look at that, terrible fitness, terrible. You know, that's an injury waiting to happen. What a rebuke of a fine, honest, loyal, capable worker that is. So to be an OC Health specialist, you really learn how to work with people in the most positive ways, being very respectful of the work site and the employer, and very respectful of workers. Or you'd get nowhere, right? I mean, don't you find that? You have to be in with them as part of the team.
And that's something that's just not always intuitive, I think, when you come out of the more traditional clinical setting. You know, it takes some time to understand your place within that team, I think.
Yeah. So that is where I think OC Health specialists are so different from PTs that have been mainly educated in PT education but have not had that OCHEL specialty. So those changes I've seen. That third one I mentioned then is the role where we went to the on-site and realized our approach had to include employers, case managers, supervisors, many directors in industry, and primarily the workers. Now, did I mention the doctor? No. Because in prevention, you really don't have a referral and you really don't have a doctor unless you are on-site working as team with a physician, and then everybody's got their role for prevention or post-offer testing. We all work together. But the physician in that on-site role does take some of it more of a team role than it does if you're just sitting in a clinic waiting for a referral or an approval. So with that, I think today's OCHealth, where we've come, is that we really have learned a great deal by being on site and doing these return to work programs. And some of these things are, one is we don't focus on pain. We focus on function. And there's nothing that worse that comes to us when we're working with a worker than somebody that has said, if it hurts, don't do it. So the pain focus of PT, in a way, is our enemy. The function focus of PT, safe function focus of PT, is our goal. Now, if someone has discomfort, we want to reduce it. If someone could potentially have discomfort, we want to prevent it. But it's all in the goal of a healthful return to work or healthful stay on the job and learn how to do your ergonomic positioning of the way you do your job better so that you don't get those symptoms that we're talking about. So that has been in the beginning of PT, when we were whole body focused, pain never came into play like it did after the 1980s when we began to focus on pain as we are primary pain treaters. But now with OCHealth, we've gone that whole circle, and we're focusing on whole people and functions.
So it seems to me like the occupational health role is an unrealized opportunity for the PT profession. How do you think we should better prepare ourselves to expand in this role?
I think to recognize that it is a specialty. And I don't know if we will get anywhere with the schools to bring more of this into schooling. I would hope so. But OCHealth is a specialty where without the right competencies and without the right attitudes and ability to be part of a larger team, we can't succeed. So you could succeed in a clinic. If I have a bad shoulder, I just referred someone to a PT today who has a bad shoulder and saying, this PT can do wonders with your shoulder. That is what a PT can do. But that PT who is expert only at shoulders or joints has to do and learn a lot more to be an OCHealth specialist. So some of the things that in our profession, I would break it into two parts. One is we definitely have to have competencies. And you don't learn these in school. And I guess, unfortunately, we have to go to specialty providers or companies that can teach us these competencies. And the first competency that we really need to know is functional movement, which is part of functional testing. And so that came in way back, like as I said, in the 80s with functional capacity assessment, where we needed to learn how to identify how much could a person lift safely. And I think that is really an issue. I think people can learn functional testing, but if they don't know when to stop someone before they get hurt, that is an issue. And I have testified in negligence cases against therapists, not against therapists, but whose case had been brought against a therapist for somebody regaining and regetting an injury from functional testing. And so usually all you're talking there is a standard of care, and the standard of care would be not to harm somebody. So my role would be this, to analyze, was the person trained? Were they aware when a person got into an unsafe area? Were they monitoring them? Or did they just let them go until the person got hurt? So standard of care in physical therapy is very important, and that is on the other side of a good standard of care would be negligence. That's been my only role. But it has shown me how many people get hurt in functional testing and bring that back to the therapist as having caused that problem. Now, I must say that looking at a standard of care, what was done, at least half the cases were thrown out because the therapist did do a standard of care. And we had a person who just wanted to create an issue, more or less. But I have seen cases where therapists in their functional testing seem to have missed that part about how to know when someone's reached their safe maximum and to stop them at that point. Now, that is a whole expertise in itself, functional testing, but it's important to learn how to adequately and safely and scientifically know how to evaluate things like lifting, carrying, climbing, bending, balance, hand coordination, all of those things that roll up into the ability to do work. Competencies in functional testing, I think, is critical. It's not just to do an FCA. I mean, people that just think, well, I can do one, I can have them do these things, and I'll punch a note into a, you know, a computer program, and now I've got a report. Well, I don't know. It seems to me when you do evaluations, there's more to it than just getting a number out of it. There's the quality of movement. There's the endurance issue. There's the coordination issue. That there's a lot more for a physical therapist to see than mainly a number. So functional testing can give you a lot of information about how the person works, not just what their number is, like how much can they lift. Now, if functional capacity testing, as I mentioned, is used in chronic cases, and it's often not paid for unless somebody is really chronic. It used to be, when I started doing this and developed functional capacity testing in the 80s, that they were used for return to work because the voc counselor would take the information, look at the job, and identify what parts of the job the person could do. So it was used for return to work, and FCAs were referred to often. Today's referral patterns often seem to be they're doing it at end of a case when they're trying to get maximum medical improvement or a disability rating, which is a terrible use of a good functional capacity assessment. You can use it for that, but a good therapist doing functional testing has so much to offer in identifying return to work potential that it is crazy that it's not used more for that. I did a talk a year or so ago to attorney claimant specialists. They worked for groups of attorneys, and then they were the ones that could, like, refer for functional testing and FCA, and they would decide when to pay for it. And one of them, I sat before my talk, and I said, you know, how do you use it? And they said, well, here's a strange thing. Somebody wanted to use an FCA. The person that I was dealing with had multiple fractures in their leg. They had pins, and they were in a cast, and then the cast came off. But it was going to be 6 months before the person was, you know, fully able with that leg for the doctor to release them to full duty. Someone suggested an FCA, and I said, no, we aren't going to pay for that till we get to the disability rating. I said, yes, but the person's able to stand, right? Yes. And walk, right? Yes. And they're going to be able to do some work, but you're not going to know the level of work they can do if you don't refer to a functional testing right now. If you wait 6 months, that person might be off work for another 6 months if you don't find out their functional abilities. And yes, you might have to update the functional testing after those last pins are removed in 6 months and the doctor gives it all clear. But it's so useful to you. So it kind of gave me the impression that we as therapists have done a very poor job of showing how beneficial FCAs are in return to work. So that's one point. But the other thing, functional testing for jobs, FCAs are just too long, they're too generic, they're all generic, they're not specific to a job. So the next way that we can be a benefit are short, specific return to work tests in the case of an injured worker. Now, do we already develop those? Maybe. Maybe if we're developing post-offer testing, we're already developing a job-specific test. Maybe there's a way that we can not only be excellent at post-offer testing, identifying if a person can do all the parts of their job, but maybe we need to blend in our post-offer testing abilities with return-to-work testing, because if anyone's going to pay for it, it's got to be short, and if an employer is going to use it, it's got to be job-specific. So if they're looking to someone come back to be a boilermaker, they need a boilermaker test at that point. And so I think that's a huge missing link that we're not offering to employers. It's true that we do. That's part of what we do in our work. We have developed return-to-work testing, and it's what has saved the employers the most money of everything, because they don't keep someone off too long, and the person can return to work sooner because they've actually been tested out that they can do the job. And if there's a part they can't do, you could modify that job temporarily. So I see that as a huge part of functional testing that we haven't moved into enough. I mentioned post-offer testing because I think many of us do that. And we already have the skills to develop a job-specific test. The difference between post-offer testing and return-to-work testing used to be that you had to pass everything to get the job if you're an applicant. Whereas in a return-to-work scenario, you need to know what parts of the job they can do and maybe how to modify the rest. So your scoring systems are going to be different in return-to-work, and the amount of job modification information you're going to give to the employer so the person can go back to work is going to be different. But it's a huge gap that people aren't doing and were needed in. Interestingly enough, if you look at the new changes in the Americans with Disabilities Act, where they've expanded the definition of people covered under the Act, it could be that a quarter to a half of people that are tested in post-offer testing require that the employer offers a modification because they fall under the definition of having a disability. And I think a lot of people doing post-offer testing miss that as well. So we can just, we don't hire people, so that's not a worry to us. We're not discriminating against anybody. But if we're not aware that even in post-offer testing, an applicant might need a job modification suggested, I think we're missing part of what we can do in that role as well.
And educating the employer as well.
You're always working with the employer. Don't you feel they know very little about the ADA compared to what we know?
Yeah, a lot of these employers, they don't exactly have their corporate legal team at their fingertips where they can, consult with a labor lawyer. So that's certainly a opportunity where we can come in and help to educate the employer a lot of times. Otherwise, they don't always understand what the confines are of pre-employment testing.
Yes, and in any training I've ever given, we teach the ADA right along with it, because we have to interpret it for employers and tell them that we can offer this part that makes it more ADA compliant, and they're going to like that because they don't know. So that's a mixture. Now we're talking about competencies, where we're talking about the competency of functional testing, and it's used in three different ways. But we've now branched over into some of the knowledge base that's also required. So a physical therapist or any therapist doing this kind of work with that doesn't have a good understanding of the ADA and the reasonable accommodation issue is really missing the boat. We could be making errors. So that's a competency or a knowledge base we need. And go back to just the physical competencies of therapists. Definitely we need to understand job functions. And we need to understand work. And so ergonomics is an easy way to say that we need to know ergonomic principles so that we can make work as least stressful as possible to make it easier for the worker to do and to make it much easier to get someone back to work. Because sometimes your ergonomic ideas come in actually when someone's going back to work. But we need to know how to change those jobs. Some ergonomics comes under, it's all the mechanical part, it's all changing a machine. But I think of ergonomics as broader than that. I think of ergonomics as the match of the worker and the work. So part of it would be how high are you reaching, how far are you reaching, how heavy are you of an object they're moving it, where are you moving it to, are there ways you can slide it, or is there equipment you can use so you don't have to have the physical stresses. That's very good. But there's other things in ergonomics that we need to know for jobs, like work pace, like how, when are people getting injured? Is it that they're working too fast and after, you know, so many repetitions they're just fatigued and they lose their ability to do it safely? Maybe it's a work pace. Maybe it is teamwork. Maybe two people aren't doing well together because one person is doing all the heavy things because their coworker isn't able to pull their load. You see those things too, don't you? It's the interactions in the workplace.
Oh, indeed. A lot of times the psychosocial issues can be just as big of a deal, if not a bigger deal, than the physical ones.
That's right. So I like to broaden ergonomics out beyond just what we think of equipment or changing positions and look at all those other facets of work, like the pace and the interaction with their coworkers, the amount of training they've had. You know, there's a whole lot of things that goes into the work site and there's some people that interact real well with their safety team and there's some that don't, and that's one of those things that we as on-site therapists get involved in. So I think two main competencies that most therapists don't have are functional testing and the ability to analyze jobs and change jobs. I think the things like work conditioning, work hardening, we understand how to develop exercise programs, and if we learn to put the work goal as a goal, instead of range of motion or pain as a goal, we then will be able to use what we already have as therapists to do better rehab, on-site or off-site in the clinic. So those are competencies. The other things that we need are more knowledge-based, like the ADA is critical, the Americans with Disabilities Act. We need to know the work comp laws in our states. If you work in multiple states, you need to know the different laws, but we need to be aware of the laws in the state. And then OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, we need to know one of the focuses of on-site is to try and reduce OSHA recordables. So that's an issue that, you know, we need to understand what those are. And then we've kind of mentioned the intangibles. When you're on site, you have to be able to work with the employer as equally respectful. We have to work with the case manager, whether it's an outside case manager or an employer case manager. We have to be able to work well with unions and even the attorneys if they come out. And certainly we have to be accepted by the workers. So those all lead to great satisfaction. And with the MDs, the physicians, so that if they're involved, it's part of a team rather than us just taking an order from them. So I see those as competencies that we need. And I want to mention one other thing to answer your question, what do PTs need to do? We need to measure our outcomes. I brought that up way back at Work Hardening when so many successful clinics could show their outcomes. And when people stopped doing that, then there was no need to use them anymore. We need to know if we are dealing with injured workers, how many that we work with compared to others. How are we reducing, or maybe we start a program and we're comparing our data to the past. How have we affected the lost time days? Have we reduced lost time days? Liberty Mutual estimates that an employer is going to pay out in multiple ways the equivalent of $1,000 a day for every lost time day of a worker. And that's in case management, it's potential medical fees, potential litigation, all of those things. If $1,000 a day is attached to a lost time day, and we can return a person to work 3 weeks earlier than they were getting returned to work, that is a great savings. But we need to compare and look at what we're able to do. Are we able to reduce medical costs? Are we able to reduce disability costs, which is short-term disability and long-term disability? Are we reducing litigation because all of these things are resolved well? Return to work is resolved well without getting attorneys involved. And one of the better things I think we can measure are satisfaction of the employer and the worker. Are they happy with this intervention that we've done in return to work? Do they feel better about it? The outcomes on prevention would certainly be reduction in OSHA recordables, and I think that reduction is a real measurement of the safety that's kind of been imbued. If we're doing post-offer testing, are we having less injuries in new hires? And if we're having less injuries in new hires, are those of lesser, are they less injurious than they were before we implemented post-offer testing? The measurement in post-offer testing, another good one is turnover. Does good post-offer testing reduce turnover? Now, turnover is often caused by someone getting hired, getting to the job, it's too hard for them, they don't like it, it's too physically difficult, and they quit. So you could get a job that's too hard and get injured, or you could get a job that's too hard and quit. So turnover is another real good measurement. So that's where we need to go back, is in embrace outcomes in all of our work.
So it's been a real treat to hear your perspective on the role of the therapist in the occupational health setting. Do you have any final thoughts or words for our listeners?
Well, I'm a physical therapist, so I see myself also as a team member of occupational therapists. So as a therapist, I really would love to see PTs get outside the box of just treating parts and pain and enjoy and take their talents into the occupational health realm. One of the things that will really be gained from this is there is such a loss of workers, the pain that's incurred of disability. There's such a loss for employers, the financial problems that come with having injured workers. Physical therapists can make such a difference in really reducing injury and returning people to work. We can make a huge difference for our communities. We also, in doing our work, and I'm sure you've done this, Chris, you can improve systems. So as you're making recommendations to a worker or a medical system, you may actually be improving how the system works, and I think that's very valuable. We can, lastly, I think, expand physical therapy in other people's minds. that we're not somebody in a clinic with a machine. And I don't think that's really the realm of how people see us, so that's really too narrow. But we really are much better professionals that have a far greater scope of what we can do. And I would like to see outside referrers and just every person be able to see physical therapists as having a greater role. Lastly, I don't know anybody in occupational health that isn't very satisfied with their work. I can't think of a better specialty for a physical therapist to be in. Well, thank you, Chris.
Sue, thanks for coming on the show. It's been very interesting, very informative, and I know I can speak for the listeners in telling you that it's been a great resource, and we thank you for all that you've done for the profession.
Thank you.
And for all our listeners out there, thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed the show, and please tune in next time.